We're talking fear tonight with Jeff Wise, author of Extreme Fear. We'll take your questions and your stories on fear when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. So, Jeff, what is that one piece of advice you'd like to give to somebody dealing with their own fear?
Well, the one piece of advice I would give is, you know, is to not judge yourself. Is don't think, well, I'm a bad person or there's something wrong with me. Observe yourself. Get to know yourself. Fear can be a doorway that you can step through to expand yourself. And I feel in our society, we're very judgmental. We feel like we should be perfect all the time. There's a lot of pressure to be the hero all the time. And it's just not realistic. That's not really how we're built. And so I would say don't beat yourself up. You know, if you feel like you shouldn't be a certain way, there's a tendency to imagine that you're not that way or to try to gloss over the difficulties that you're facing. A lot of people have panic attacks. They get to that point because they're not willing to accept that they're under stress. And so we have to be just more compassionate towards ourselves. Sometimes it's much more easy to feel compassionate towards other people than towards ourselves. So I just say, you know, give yourself a break. Recognize that fear and stress are something that all people feel and that all people have to deal with. And just, you know, give yourself a break.
You have written about the 2012 prophecy, haven't you?
I did. I last month I had a cover of Popular Mechanics. They came to me and they said, look, we know that a lot of people are going to be thinking about 2012. There's going to be a lot in the media about the world ending, and we don't think that the world is going to end. We don't believe that the Mayans knew what was happening. But if they did, if it was going to happen, I guess two questions. Could the world really end in 2012? And part two, if it does end in 2012, what would it be? And so I talked to scientists and thinkers and so forth. And the conclusion, I mean, people can look it up themselves, but the conclusion is that, sure, the world could end. I mean, there's things that we could do or could have happen to us that could end the world. And so I looked at 12 of the ways that people have talked about as potential threats. And it was interesting that some of them were pretty outlandish or outright impossible. But two of them really, a lot of people were telling me, you know, as much as we hate to say it, these could take place. And those were atomic bombs. I mean, I'm 45 years old, so I spent my entire childhood hearing about the fact that the world could be blown up at any time. And it was weird how the Berlin Wall fell. And that idea just kind of fell out of favor so dramatically that you don't really hear it anymore. But those weapons are still there. And, you know, more... You know, obviously, this is what the whole Israeli-Iran tension is about. And then the other thing is the threat of a pandemic, as described in the movie Contagion. And the fear is not just that, you know, these viruses are out there and, you know, the bird flu and so forth, but that, you know, it's as technology gets more and more sophisticated, it becomes more and more easy for a guy like me. You know, if I decide to go crazy and become somebody wants to end the world, I could, you know, mix together these viruses and so forth. And so those are the two real things that, you know, could in 2012. There's other things that could happen, you know, in the future. But, you know, we're not going to be hit by an asteroid and wiped out in 2012 because we know where all the big stuff is. There's lots of little things that zip around and pop up on the radar screens. And they could take out, like, Los Angeles, which would be, you know, kind of it would definitely be a bad thing, let's put it that way. But it's not going to end civilization.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Barbara in Austin, Texas, to get us going. Hey, Barb, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was kind of fascinated by Jeff Wise's, I guess, mental analogy of a mental cul-de-sac. And I feel like my daughter is kind of in that. It sounds odd, but she's afraid to go to school. And it's like she's gotten herself into this mental cul-de-sac that if she goes to school, she's going to have an anxiety attack. And we've actually got her in a hospital right now trying to figure out why in the world this kid is so afraid of going to school. Do you have any insight you can offer on that?
Yeah, you know, in my book, I write a lot about anxiety, and it's tricky because what happens is the fear is so unpleasant that it becomes itself an aversive stimulus that you want to avoid. And so this is why anxiety can so easily spiral out of control. I had some social anxiety episodes myself, and so I know what it's like. You know, you just feel your heart starts to race. And you feel that nausea. It's a very unpleasant feeling. And
yeah, she has these actual shaking, you know, things going on and stuff. I mean, she'll actually start shaking and everything and has, you know, obvious symptoms of fear and everything. And she loves school. She's, you know, really bright and all that kind of stuff. But we're trying to figure out what's causing this and how to help her get past it.
You know, it can be very baffling. The root of anxiety can be deep in the brain, and it's hard to know where it really starts. But once it does start, it's like a feedback loop where, because the feeling of fear is itself aversive, you know, it can very quickly self-trigger. And you know, and so for her, the trigger has become school, and it might have started being something else. But because she now consciously identifies school with this horrible feeling, it's treatable. And it sounds like you're obviously working with psychologists right now. Sorry?
Yes, we are. We are working with.
Yeah. So one of the there's a form of therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is often used and has been effective in cases. And also, some Prozac-type drugs can be effective, and sometimes they resolve in time. But you know, anxiety is one of these things. We were just talking about what people can do to handle fear in general. It is our society is very non-compassionate when it comes to mental illness and psychological problems. And as someone who had anxiety myself, I recognize that, you know, you don't want to be feeling like this, and it only makes it worse if you feel like, well, I shouldn't be feeling like this, because the fact is your brain has decided to have this kind of response. And, you know, if you had a stomach ache, you would take some Pepto-Bismol and you wouldn't feel, wow, I shouldn't be having a stomach ache, you know. And it's just a question of recognizing what the mechanism is and taking steps to deal with the mechanism. And not to say that it's easy, but it's easier if we don't, you know, let society judge us or make us feel bad about the fact that we have anxiety. This is just my personal belief, but I think it's a way that a perfectly normal, well-functioning brain can find itself operating in a non-optimal way, but it is treatable. It can be dealt with, and I wish the best for your daughter. I know that it's a very, very unpleasant kind of syndrome.
What do you think of bullies? And there's fear of bullies.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, kids can be very cruel. You know, it's a time where, you know, we're social creatures, and as we evolve in our personal psychological development, one of the things we reach a stage where we have to learn to create hierarchies and fit into these hierarchies, and it's almost like we're recreating the stages of civilization, I think. And when you're, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 or whatever the age it is, I should say flat out, I'm absolutely no expert in this, and I haven't studied it or anything. But you know, the instinct for social hierarchy, is the cause of a lot of stress throughout life. And that's, I mean, when you're afraid of standing in front of a group at work or what have you, that is a manifestation of social fear, of our instinct for finding a place in the social hierarchy. And I think people who are afraid of their place in the social hierarchy are more likely to bully, because to assert their place, their dominance in the hierarchy. And I think a lot of people who are bullies, you know, 10 years later 15 years later would be horrified to know, to think what they've done when they're adolescents. But, you know, adolescence is all about learning these roles and making mistakes.
That's true. So true. Let's go to Paul in Norfolk, Virginia. First time caller.
Hey, George,
Paul.
How you doing?
Good. Good to have you.
Hey, I love your show. And, Jeff, I think the conversation you guys have going is fascinating. I kind of wanted to call. I got something to add. I'm 25. I've been a police officer since I was 21. And obviously, I get plenty of situations where fear is definitely a factor. They say about the job, about 90% of it is kind of laid back. And then that 10% is where you have the good action and stuff going. And I notice that when I'm kind of in one of those times where there's kind of like a, you know, an intense situation, whether it be chasing somebody on foot or in a car or getting in a fight or something like that, when it happens, you know, obviously I'm there, I'm in control and stuff, but it seems like as soon as the dust is settled and either, you know, everybody's in custody or the scene has been settled, what have you, it seems like I come back to, and it's like I've kind of been observing the whole scenario the whole time. I noticed this phenomenon for, you know, several months, and then I remember a few years back actually reading up online and discovering that apparently a lot of police officers experience something called third-person syndrome, where they kind of go through this experience of at the end of it kind of, you know, you're sort of like a spectator in the entire event. It's always a good feeling, obviously, to land back on the ground and you're okay. You know, you're going to be going home at the end of the night, but it's I don't know if that's something, you know, you have a little bit of research in or can comment on, but that's something I definitely experience on a regular basis. I find it kind of fascinating that our brains do something like that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting phenomenon. The psychological term for it is dissociation. And it feels like you're, as you said, it's almost like watching a movie sometimes. Is that what you're talking about?
I would guess, yes.
Okay. So it happens a lot to people, lots of people under stress, and it's a way that a very stressful situation can feel less stressful because it doesn't feel like really it's happening to you. It can be protective in that sense, in that it reduces the emotional impact of what's happening, and it might allow you to act in a case in which you otherwise might freeze up. It has been linked in some studies to an increased risk of post-traumatic stress disorder. And in studies, there have actually been studies of special forces soldiers who or Navy SEALs who undergo a particularly rigorous and stressful kind of training. Those who undergo this and report more dissociation are more likely to drop out or to have stress after the fact. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. It is a potentially protective effect, but it can also signal risk for, you know, long-term bad effects.
Okay, next up we go to Diane in Los Angeles, west of the Rockies. Diane, go ahead.
Hello, both of you. Thank you so much for your show, and thank you for taking my call. I just love it. George, I haven't called you since 98 before you worked there constantly. And I was wondering if you've ever... Oh, and also condolences on your dad. When you gave that night the story of your dad, my heart felt like you had stabbed me because my husband had just passed, and he was also a Navy veteran from World War II.
Okay.
It just hurt me. I was wondering, Jeff, if you ever interviewed in all the research in your writings or your books, people that have all the similar reactions, such as you said, the slow motion and seeing every drop in the car, seeing every little blade of grass, that type of a thing. Have you ever... and even that didn't have the fear involved in that?
Well,
I see all of this slow motion before an accident, before a crime. I see it twice in slow motion. Then I see it in a speeded up version. I mean, it's accelerated with noise and sound effects and everything. And then it happens, and I feel so horrible. But I don't get fear. I go into fast action, into clearing the crowd away from the victim, into doing anything I could help. You know, pillows, towels, get away, everybody. Don't touch anything in the scene. And I've been doing that all my life, and I don't know why I have no fear.
Oh, are you an EMT or?
I don't. You know, every show you do, George, I feel like, oh, my God, that's me. Oh, my God, that's me. Every show. It's just I do all of these things. I see them in dreams. I see them in, in life, I see them in the mirror. If I look in the mirror, I see a volcano, I know it's going to be. But who do you call? You can't tell somebody, oh, there's going to be a volcano in Sicily, you know. But I see these things, and we used to go out at night. My husband, like I say, just passed. We'd go out at night to eat dinner after 12, and we just about every night we'd save people. Every night. And we wonder whatever happened to those people. And I'd see it before, and he would say, what do you want me to do, make a U-turn? Yes. And it would happen, but I would see it twice in slow motion. Every detail, like people's eyes, and we were like maybe 3 blocks away. You know, I'd see that lady there, oh, my God, they're going to kidnap her. There's nobody around. There comes the car, yeah.
That's pretty magical to be able to do
well,
that.
Well, I thank God. I think it's a gift from God. I really do.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
And we tried so hard to save, and we did, and I don't think we ever lost anybody. But I don't have the fear, and that in effect scares me because I've lived a very stressful life since I was, before 3 years old, I was taking care of people. And so it's been stressful because I worry about them, their health, their well-being, and I don't take care of myself. And I did get cancer from the stress, I did.
Well, you know, it's actually fairly common for people to report that when they're in, when they find themselves suddenly in a scary situation like combat or a police type situation or an accident and so forth, people often say that they feel no fear in that instant. They do what needs to be done. As we were talking earlier, they might feel like they're watching a movie. And only afterwards, when the danger has passed, do they find themselves collapsing in a shivering heap, and then any injuries that they may have sustained, only then do they start to feel the pain, and they can feel they might report feeling the fear well after. In the book, I tell the story of a guy who survived an avalanche, and it wasn't until that night that he felt the pain of his bruises and contusions and so forth. And it was only when he went back to the wrecking yard and saw the car and how it had been smashed that he just fell to his knees, because then the fear just swept over him.
Well, you know, when you look at all this, the extreme fear and how people react to it, what would you say might be one of the worst cases you ever heard about where somebody just loses it, Jeff?
I mean, it's so easy to go to 10, you know, it's so easy to get, you know, I write in the book, there's four different ways that you can panic. Evolution has given us these tools. It's like a toolkit, to respond automatically, to different kinds of danger. And in the book, I tell a story of a young woman at the time who was a hydrologist working in a remote canyon in Utah. And she was working on the riverbank, and she looked up and she saw a mountain lion looking at her from the bank. And she had studied predator behavior, so she understood you're not supposed to run away. So she kind of slowly backed away, and the cat started to come towards her. And over the course of the next few minutes, she went through all the different ways that you can panic. Running away, fainting, freezing, passing out. And she ultimately survived, obviously, because she told me the story. But, you know, we tend to think of panic as a very dysfunctional thing to do. You know, your first bit of advice is always don't panic. But in fact, the panic response evolved for a specific reason. It evolved to take us out of danger. If we find ourselves in a situation where our conscious brain obviously must have done something wrong to get us to this place, then the conscious brain just gets thrown in jail, essentially.
All right, hold on, Jeff. Let's come back for final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Dr. Kevin Nelson joins us, the spiritual doorway in the brain, a neurologist's search for the God experience. When we come back, more of your calls with Jeff Wise on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Jeff Wise. We'll take your final phone calls here as well. What's your next project, Jeff?
Well, I'm working on another story for Psychology Today and for Men's Health about mistakes. And I'm working on a book project about self-control. You know, fear is a way that we struggle to stay in control of ourselves, and I'm interested in the way that our country, our culture, and in fact around the world, people are having more and more trouble staying in control of their eating, of their spending, and it's fascinating to me to look at the underlying causes in the brain and in our culture for why that should happen.
Okay, to the phones we go. First time caller, James in Los Angeles. Welcome to the program, James.
Good morning.
Hey.
I just wanted to say that if you want to know if you have the right stuff, do dangerous stuff, but train. I'm a retired Army officer, and in skydiving, you go through training, you do everything, and I mean besides from airborne operations where you do a static line jump, when you skydive, you jump out. If you have a malfunction, they train you to do it. My first malfunction, my mind worked like a computer. There was no fear. I didn't have time. When the canopy wasn't functioning, I had to cut away. I did everything perfect. And I remember my mind going, USPA, United States Parachute Association regulations say no cutaways below 1,500 feet. I looked at my altimeter. I said, I've got so much time to still work with my canopy. As my time went down, finally I said, it's time to cut away. I cut away, and at first I couldn't pull my ripcord on my reserve chute. So I remember going back into training and saying, stop, look, reach, pull. And then I got it. And then after that, it was landing on the reserve. Once I landed on the ground, I stood up and said, wow, my first malfunction. At that time, my legs went out from under me. I fell on the ground. I mean, I was literally shaking with fear. And as one of my buddies ran up to me and asked me, are you okay? All I could say was, I don't know. And after a while, I could finally get up and walk, and it was all over. But when you do things like that, you know you got the right stuff, and you know that in an emergency, you're going to do what you're trained or supposed to do.
All right.
That's an amazing story.
That's
exactly what I was talking about earlier, where people, they don't feel the emotion of fear until after the danger is over, and then they just can collapse in a heap. And basically, that part of your brain that is focusing your energy, keeping you dialed in on task, that is no longer empowered. It takes itself away. It takes itself offline, and then you're just left with your fear, and you just collapse. And it's amazing. I love that kind of story. I mean, it just really shows what the human mind is capable of. I mean, not everyone would have responded in that same way, and I think that's really what the military has spent a lot of time and money trying to figure out how can you separate people who will respond like that when they're in intense danger from someone who's going to crumble. And it's so far still impossible to predict just by giving someone a psychological test or looking at their bodies to know who's going to be of what type.
You know, you're talking about why people do these silly things, why they make foolish errors when they have more common sense than that. Why do they do this, Jeff?
Well, I wouldn't say they. I would say us. I say we all have these built-in tendencies because, as I was saying at the very top of the show, that our brains are usually operate on autopilot, where most of what we do is habit and unconscious automatic behavior, and so our brains it's very efficient to operate like that. We're basically we operate by using a part of the brain that's very simple and runs by using these rules of thumbs called heuristics. And so they're fast and they're efficient, but they leave us open to mistakes where we're in a slightly unusual situation. And I think we've all experienced this where I do this all the time where, say, I'm cleaning up and I put my car keys over here just to get them out of the way while I clean, and I intend to put them back where they belong, but then I'm sort of in this automatic routine that I do. And because I haven't really engaged my conscious mind enough when I put them over here, I immediately forget that I've put them over there. And so time and time again, I find myself, roaming around, where did I put the keys? And, I mean, who doesn't do this kind of thing every day? And it's because of this very kind of simple miscommunication between the automatic and the conscious brain that's why we make mistakes. So there's a reason. We don't make mistakes because we're dumb or because we're losing it or we're getting too old. It's because our brains are they operate on a simple pattern that is efficient and uses less energy, but it opens us up for mistakes. We're designed to make mistakes. And one of the things that I write about is that we shouldn't beat ourselves up when we make mistakes, but we should, you know, just recognize this is part of being a human being, is making mistakes. We're all fallible. We're designed to be fallible. And if you're making the kinds of mistakes that are really embarrassing, like by complimenting a non-pregnant woman on her pregnancy, you know, we can learn from that. We can become better versions of ourselves. And a mistake, there have been studies of people who make mistakes, and people tend to respond to mistakes in one of two ways. They either deny it, or minimize it, or pretend it didn't happen, or they embrace it. They say, look, I made this mistake. I'm going to learn from it. I'm going to try harder. And I'm going to do better in the future. And that's a very healthy way. And we can approach many things in our life that way.
Next up, we go east of the Rockies, Sean in Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Sean.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Jeff. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good, Sean.
Great, thanks.
All right, awesome. My question was, ultimately, like, the original theory, the whole idea was about fear and how fear somehow take us over, like, one way or another. Like, fear usually controls most people. So, like, my question was, ultimately, if I'm not scared, like, you know, I just lost a kitty cat, like, 2 days ago. And my fear of losing him was actually, it might sound ridiculous, but it was, you know, it resulted in so many psychological horrible things. Like I wanted to end my life to be with him.
Over a cat? And, really?
Well, the idea wasn't so much about him being a cat, but he's a member of the family.
Well, I know, but...
And
you don't end your life that way.
Oh, I'm not saying I would. I mean... I've already been through the grievance process and all that, but what I was talking about, like, with fear, like, fear is like, well, I never considered the fact that I could lose, you know, such a close member to the family, or let alone even another human being in my family. So when it comes down to fear, like, how can you deal with the fear of dealing with
death?
A major loss.
All right. How do you do that, Jeff?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think that's really the big question.
And a justifiable fear.
It's a justifiable fear. I mean, we're all going to die. I mean, that's the uncomfortable reality that tends to get glossed over in our culture, especially. But, you know... And I'm sorry to hear about your loss. I know it can be really devastating to lose a cat, not to minimize that. It happens very commonly that people there's actually I was in Austria recently, and there's an expression in German that basically translates as better a fearful ending than a fear without end. And the idea is, you know, we can just eat ourselves up with fear about an outcome. And then when that outcome comes, it can almost be liberating because we no longer have the fear. Many, many times, the emotion of fear is worse than the emotion of the loss or whatever it is that we were dreading. And so that's something just to recognize about our own human experience, that, you know, say bad things will happen to us, and that's part of the deal that we get when we show up mysteriously in this universe. And you know, fear is not something we should just try to erase or avoid or eliminate from our lives. Fear is a part of the balance of emotions that we are given to experience, and it's part of the full complement of richness that being alive is. And you know, the my goal is not to let it to consume you, or to, more importantly, to let it prevent you from doing all the things that you can do or should do in your life. I feel like in my own life I've struggled against fear, And I felt like if I give in to this fear, I'm not going to have the opportunities. And I'm sure there have been times when I let fear stop me from taking a risk or taking a challenge or stepping through a doorway to something that could have been very life-enhancing.
No doubt. Rulon in Chicago on the wildcard line. Hi, Rulon. Thanks for holding.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to compliment Jeff on the fact when he read that 447 accident report or whatever that he picked out what the problem was, and it's a design flaw of all Airbuses, that they don't have synchronous flight controls. They have computers fly on these airplanes, and they just have joysticks for the pilots to put their input into the computer, and the computer makes a decision to fly the airplane, which it did in this case when the guys couldn't figure out what happened when the autopilot kicked off and everything. And because the co-pilot had the stick all the way back, and the captain, the guy that was sitting in the captain's seat, didn't realize what was going on until just like you said, the last seconds. And that's amazing for someone who's not a pilot to figure out, or not a commercial pilot. Did you talk at all about the Hero and the Hudson airplane?
No, we haven't done that yet.
Chesley did a wonderful job on that.
He sure did. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, that happened while I was writing the book, and so I got it into one of the later chapters, and it was a great example for how preparation is the best solution. Sullenberger was himself a glider pilot, so he knew all about landing a plane without power. He was also a safety expert, so he was someone who had studied and had, just as the pilot I talked about earlier, the English pilot who lost his wing at 1,000 feet, he had a deep intuitive understanding of how people can respond in a dangerous situation and how he should respond. And so he was really the perfect person to be in charge of that plane. He came up with a novel solution. Like, how many pilots think about, I'm going to land this plane on a river? I don't think it had ever been done before, at least exactly in that way. So, yeah, no, he deserves to be called a hero. And it's funny how, all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation that you never expected to be in, and it's going to be the defining moment of his whole life. And I think that's true of many of us. We feel we will never forget that moment when we are confronted by an attacker or caught in a avalanche or whatever it is. George, I was on Facebook between breaks, and one of the readers named Shane Anthony said that I should ask you about, you had a situation like this where you were in Mexico.
Oh, yeah, about a month and a half ago. And it was truly almost probably would have been a kidnapping. And we got out of it in strangely bizarre circumstances. But ever since then, the State Department's issued warnings all over the place. They just issued another one today, the state of Texas did, to college kids during spring break.
Wow.
Not a good situation.
Did you feel like you were in a different psychological place?
Well, let me tell you something. There was no fear. It did not kick in. What did kick in was this survival mode, take care of it, and let's get stuff done. I mean, this was a comedy of errors, Jeff. This was the van breaking down in the middle of no man's land, a driver who was as nervous and shaky as anybody I've ever seen, a door latch to open up the door that broke off in my hand so the door wouldn't open. I mean, it was a classic case of, uh-oh, here we go. Mm-hmm. But no fear, not at that point. I mean, I was too busy reacting to how to get out of it.
What about afterwards?
Afterwards, it was more of, boy, were we lucky. Right. And, the fear factor just never hit. I don't know
but
if that's unusual.
Remember it.
Oh, yeah, never forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Never forget it.
I think, my grandmother since passed away, but when she was in her late 90s, she was in a nursing home, and I would go and visit with her and talk to some of her friends, and they would be talking about things that happened to them in the 40s, a lifetime ago, but it was so vivid in their memories, these emotionally powerful memories that just stay with you. And again, it's nature's way of helping to keep you alive. The important stuff stays with you.
So true. All right, let's take a few more calls here before we're done. Steve in San Diego. Go ahead, Steven.
Thank you, George. Thank you, Jeff.
Sure thing.
Yeah, I could lecture for hours on your subject. Real quickly, I just give several examples of why we are a nation and a species of cowards. 2,000 years ago, we would rather give our firstborn son to slaughter by the government than stand up to the government. We all were silent in acquiescence when Kennedy died suspiciously, and even after when his brother died suspiciously, we all just shut up like a see-no-evil, speak-no-evil monkey. Now, when John Lennon was killed, there was no trial for the killer. We refused to acknowledge a photograph that proves Stephen King is the man who got John's autograph, not Mark Chapman. And the people of Bangor, Maine would let America go to hell and admit the truth in front of their face and expose Stephen King.
What are you saying?
LennonMurderTruth.com.
No, come on. Give me a break. Diane in Ontario, Canada, east of the Rockies.
Hi. I'm not sure how to word this. I've had severe car accidents, and I found out I had a form of amnesia and head trauma. And when I came out of it, I found I swore a lot. That's one part. And I had dreamt about my accidents before, so I think that kept me from losing my mind entirely. And the other thing is, it's kind of like you don't know if you're like awake or dreaming, but I had a healing and I saw light come through my body, but it's like I was observing myself. And then I realized 2 years later, it's like the more aware I've become, the more terrorized I kind of am. Like, it's kind of like, oh my God, what did I go through? And what part of the brain sees you have light come through you, or do you know what I'm?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly what you experienced, but as for the idea of like watching, feel like you're watching yourself. This idea that we were talking earlier about dissociation. You know, the brain creates for us an illusion of a unitary mind. We feel like we're this little tight little. There's like a little homunculus inside our brain, and when you're under stress, the parts of the conscious experience can start to unravel and to come apart. And one of them is this sense of the viewer, and it becomes this. It comes removed from the sense of the doer, and so you feel like you're someone else watching yourself. It's a sort of a strange phenomenon. And this is what's so interesting about human experience and these far reaches of the human experience where the normal psychological reality can become changed.
Absolutely. Jeff, I want to thank you for being on the program, Extreme Fear, the Science of Your Mind in Danger. So if you're ever in a situation where you're really fearful, just get it together and do what you have to do to get out. Make sure you stick with us all week long. Great programs for you here on Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.